word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 Coming up on Word of Mouth, farmers market frauds, exposing big box veggies and vendors posing as locals at community markets. And what makes an audiobook great? An editor tells us what it takes to be a superstar reader.
There are some audiobooks that maybe will appeal to some people and not others. You know, I think I'd rather listen to a traditional tale than Weird Al for too long.
And the pluses and minuses of guerrilla weddings. While some couples love the adventure of getting hitched in public spaces, museums, or national parks, there is a risk of uninvited guests.
Forget about, you know, a person. What about a moose or a bear? If you're really far into the woods, I think that's going to cause you more trouble than actually getting kicked out.
Plus, what social media strategists can learn from the hyper-viral Facebook posts of a tiny New Hampshire animal shelter. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth puts new ideas on a long leash after the news.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
The Word of Mouth.
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 Well, definitely.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, faux farmers markets, big box veggies, and slippery vendors taking advantage of consumer trust in outdoor markets. We'll hear about the provincial produce posers. We'll also hear about a small animal shelter that lives large on Facebook and Inking the Atomic Bomb. A graphic novelist takes on the history, science, and iconic imagery of the Manhattan Project. But we begin with guerrilla weddings. Maybe it's the sluggish economy, the flash mob legacy, the social media age wish for attention, or the ongoing American urge for originality. Couples everywhere are ditching the choreographed trappings of traditional weddings for simpler, spontaneous services in public spaces on the sly. Alyssa Abkowitz wrote about this increasingly popular way to tie the note for Smart Money magazine and joins us now. Alyssa, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So what makes a guerrilla wedding?
Well, there are lots of things that make a guerrilla wedding, but the best thing is that it's impromptu and it's supposed to save you a lot of money. A lot of people back in the olden days obviously did this. We've always seen eloping if, you know, parents, for example, don't approve of a union. So it isn't new in that sense, but it is new in the sense that the recession obviously has spurred some couples who, you know, maybe rather save their money up for a down payment on a home than, you know, to spend $25,000 on a reception to say, hey, you know, let's go back to this idea. Let's look at this and see if we can get married somewhere that doesn't cost a lot of money, plan it fairly quickly, invite fewer people, and in the end of the day, still have the exact same outcome, but at, you know, a fraction of the cost of a regular traditional wedding.
So you've written about several different kinds of locations where people spontaneously get married. What are some of the favorites from researching for the article?
Mm-hmm. A big favorite is parks, and you all, obviously being in New Hampshire with the White Mountains right behind you, are just, you know, it's a bastion for guerrilla weddings.
It's like a reception hall for guerrilla weddings.
It really is, because one thing that people love about parks is you can sort of find that private atmosphere without, you know, having to cordon off the entire place to yourself. A lot of times, parks don't cost anything to get into, or they cost, you know, $10 to park your car. You can go there and find a quiet, beautiful, personal place and just sort of pop a squat and bring in your officiant and get it done.
Well, the impromptu nature, however, means that, you know, there may be an element of danger. You could get kicked out of a park if there are too many people gathering.
Oh, absolutely. You can definitely get kicked out, or even worse, I mean, goodness, forget about, you know, a person. What about a moose or a bear? If you're really far into the woods, I think that's going to cause you more trouble than actually getting kicked out.
Have you actually heard of any, you know, epic guerrilla wedding fails, things that just didn't come off?
Yes, well, it wasn't a complete fail, but it was cut short. There was a couple out in Los Angeles who was in a courtyard outside of a train station, and that courtyard usually rents out for $6,000 for weddings. Well, they decided to go and do this, and about probably three-fourths of the way through the ceremony, security guards came up and said, you guys have to stop this immediately. And the officiant was like, look, I'm almost to the I do's. Let me just, like, get through this. And so they quickly had to race through, say the I do's, and then literally up and scrambled, or the security guards were going to call the cops on them.
Well, you know, it's not just the couple, but the guests have to be kind of game for this kind of thing.
You bring up a great point, Virginia. A lot of couples find that picking out the guest list is one of the hardest parts of doing a guerrilla wedding, because in nature, it's supposed to be quick and small. And so that means, you know, that your grandma may not be invited, and that might really upset her. Mm. In one example, we spoke with a couple who got married out in Colorado and required all their guests to literally ski down half the mountain and then trek into the woods so that they weren't seen. And it's like, if you're not in good enough shape, you may not be attending that wedding.
It feels like there's been this trend towards, you know, curating weddings, making them very editorial. You know, you've seen the photographs with couples doing very unwedding-like things mm-hmm. in their photos, you know, hailing a cab. Mm-hmm. I've also seen people coordinating their first dances as a kind of a performance. So is this the next step in that?
So many people now want that personalized wedding experience. The wedding planning industry just blew up so much. It's a $54 billion industry these days.
Wow.
So you've seen sort of a backlash to it in some ways of people saying, we want to do our own thing. We want to do something that represents us. You definitely see it in the way that they may have, you know, a big giant brownie
right.
instead of a wedding cake. And
donuts,
this, you know,
I've seen
exactly,
mountains
donuts.
Of donuts. But at the same time, these are exactly the kind of things that get broadcast on YouTube. Maybe, you know, maybe in the hope of going viral. It's sort of, this is our little event, but we want to make it as public as possible. Do you think that's true?
That's the irony of all this, is you want it to be private, but you want it to be public. And I think one of the things that makes that so true is just sort of the risk factor there.
Well, Alyssa, we found on deep background that you happen to be engaged.
Yes, I am.
What are your plans? Does the guerrilla wedding have any allure for you?
Well, it did at first. I have to admit, Virginia, it was something that I really liked the idea of not a lot of hassle. But then as my fiance and I started looking into this, we realized that it takes a lot of planning. You got to make sure that the security guards, you know, are not going to be right where you want to be, or that there's not going to be some huge parade or graduation dinner going on. And so we actually decided, after looking into it, to go the traditional route.
Well, all the best to you, Alyssa.
Thank you, Virginia.
Alyssa Abkowitz is contributor to The Wall Street Journal and staff writer for Smart Money magazine, where she wrote about the stealth wedding. You can read the article at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't worry, it's not that big of a commitment.
It's a beautiful night. We're looking for something done to do. Hey, baby, I think I want to marry you.
Is it the look in your eyes, or is it this dancing juice? Who cares, baby? I think I want to marry you. Well, I know this little chapel on the boulevard we can go. No one will know.
Oh, come on, girl.
The ability to share personal updates, photos, or guerrilla event plans has made Facebook the go-to social network for some 900 million users. After a lackluster IPO, the question of how Facebook will cash in on its huge user base remains. Many small businesses and nonprofits are also struggling to turn Facebook fans into customers or supporters. Word of Mouth producer Todd Bookman found a small operation with a big Facebook presence that could teach others a thing or two about motivating users to take action. Todd just followed the tracks to one New Hampshire animal shelter.
Simba is a puggle, the designer term for a cross between a pug and a beagle. Brown with a smushed face and a pronounced underbite, Simba is the ugliest/cutest/ugliest dog in the Manchester Animal Shelter right now. And she's also the biggest hit on their Facebook page.
That was huge for a post. Yeah. 35 comments, and I'm not even sure how many likes. It was on fire yesterday.
Jessica Patterson volunteers at the small rescue shelter as their social media coordinator. When a dog or cat gets picked up by animal control or shows signs of abuse, they land here. Patterson will post a photo or upload a short video. It's like an Amber Alert for animals. The hope is that someone in the shelter's online network might recognize the dog or cat from their neighborhood and can help reunite them with an owner. Or if no owner comes forward, maybe someone will fall in love with a mutt like Simba and decide to adopt. There is constant activity on their site.
We do post a lot. Sometimes I wonder if we post too much because, you know, when you look at the rules of Facebook, you know, you should post like you know, one or two posts a day or something, and we do multiple posts a day.
Patterson's two-year-old son Dylan plays with a German Shepherd while his mom manages the site. She's online day and night, updating stories of lost dogs and found cats. It's a model not every business or nonprofit can follow, but the constant updates are proving to be a success. The shelter has over 11,000 likes on Facebook. To help put that in perspective, NHPR, this very radio station, has less than half that many. The Manchester Animal Shelter, with a paid staff of 3, is punching way above their weight class.
Can you give me a my name is, and this is what I do?
Like for work, me? Beth Zelog. I am NHPR's on-air fundraising and member services manager.
Beth works down the hall and is all over the shelter's Facebook page, checking in on stray cats and dogs.
People go online to see what the status is of an animal, whether it was adopted or whether it was found. And you think about that in the back of your head, especially when you're spending time with your animals. You know, did that animal find a home? You're hoping for the best so that the next time you go on Facebook, you'll see that it was adopted or it was found. And you just feel great, you know.
You've seen those posters on telephone poles, right, of a lost cat or dog? What you never get to find out is the end of the story. Did anybody ever find Fido? One reason animal lovers flock to this Facebook page is because you get that conclusion to the story. There are regular updates on adoptions and reunifications. Beth Zelog says it's like an online soap opera with a devoted following.
I think there's just this passion. There's just this feeling that people have towards animals. They're like babies to some people.
Simba is one of those babies, one with a face only a mother could love. Part of the reason the Puggle is so popular is that she arrived at the shelter with pink painted toenails. She's someone's dog, maybe a little girl's best friend. Whether or not she gets reunited with that friend is a story 11,000 people are watching, and they can't wait to see how it ends. For Word of Mouth, I'm Todd Bookman.
See a picture of Simba and learn more about the many success stories of the Manchester Animal Shelter. Go to wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, The Birth of the Bomb gets the graphic novel treatment. We'll talk to the artist and author of Trinity when Word of Mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
As the Atomic Energy Commission's newest A-bomb tests make headlines, just released official films take you behind the scenes of previous tests for close-ups of secret research never before made public. Here in an Air Force laboratory plane circling high above the target, volunteers test their visual reactions to the cosmic brilliance of an atomic burst. Protective methods against the intense glare are proven by the ultimate test.
There's not a lot to see in Los Alamos, New Mexico these days. A little over 67 years ago, the desert site was immortalized in one of the most terrifying and iconic series of images made by humans. There, a group of scientists captured on film the first atomic bomb test, a speck of light transforming into an orb burning hotter than the surface of the sun that then turned into a mushroom cloud. Now a universal symbol of colossal destruction and a new phase in human history. Jonathan Fetter-Vorm is co-founder of Two Fine Chaps, a graphic imprint dedicated to adapting and illustrating classic works of literature and natural science. He's also author and illustrator of Trinity, a graphic history of the first atomic bomb, about the events that led to the bomb's creation. And Jonathan joins us now from Argo Studios in New York to tell us more. Jonathan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. And really, I guess, deeply moved, I think, by looking at this story again, all in black and white. A long, winding story of both history and science and human capacity for discovery and destruction. What made you want to explore the first atomic bomb? And where do you begin with something like that?
Well, my earliest memories of the story were actually being told about the project by my grandfather, who worked at the Hanford site, which is where they built the first industrial-scale plutonium reactor. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed by the mystery of it all. He, of course, worked on this project for years and had no idea what he was doing because everybody was kept in secret until the day the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima. And so that early mystery is sort of what propelled me down this path. And it's interesting you bring up those early images that they took at the Trinity site. Mm-hmm. When I first saw those photographs of the bombs exploding in the first hundredths of a second, they're just uncanny. They're very hard to describe and very hard to draw as well.
And you sort of slow them down, obviously, and get into that mystery.
Yeah, try to preserve that moment for as long as possible.
At Trinity, again, let's remind our listeners, is this site where that initial test took place?
Right. Okay. Yeah. It's the code name for the test and is now called the Trinity site. It was a word coined by Dr. Oppenheimer. No one's quite sure why he chose that. He left some enigmatic notes to that effect of quoting from a John Donne poem. But yes, that's the code name for the test.
He was quite a philosophical sort. And of course, along with the events, the historical events, you have historical characters, Truman, Stalin, Churchill. You seem to like Oppenheimer a bit. We see him, he's always lighting a cigarette or has one hanging out of his mouth. Were you especially fascinated with him?
I was. And again, it comes back to this idea of the mystery. He became a good symbol for the difficulty of this topic in general. He was a man who held quite radically different positions about the nature of atomic bombs throughout his career. And so I kept coming back to him as sort of this touchstone for the fact that these are very hard issues to grapple. And a sort of ambivalence is in a way a very honest approach to this.
Mm-hmm. He says, in fact, you write in the book, speaking years later, he recalled his reaction to the first test. I remember the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, and now I became death, the destroyer of worlds.
Yeah, it's quite a poignant response to the test.
Yeah, I can see this. You know, this graphic novel is a great teaching tool, but a subject that's very difficult for young kids. So which demographic do you think the book is best suited for?
Well, when I was writing it, I was hoping to make it accessible both to high schoolers and maybe early college students. But really, I want it to be something that anyone, probably above the age of 15 can read, maybe even younger. It does deal with some very intense issues, but I try to do it in a way that makes it accessible to a very wide audience.
But you didn't choose a kind of chronological narrative. What was behind that for you?
Well, I was experimenting with trying to tell the story in a way that reflected the momentum of the history. The bomb came out of years worth of work from scientists all over the world. And so there's a lot of jumping around. And part of what I wanted to do was show how once all these pieces start falling into place, as you get closer and closer to the date of the bomb test, certain outcomes become inevitable. There's a sort of critical momentum to it all. So that required a lot of jumping back and forth.
You come up with some great visual metaphors to help us understand concepts. You know, of course, there's the falling dominoes. That's one of them. But anything that you came up with that was really your favorite, you thought, yeah, I really got it that time.
The balls of clay, I was trying to describe how uranium enrichment works and really try to illustrate how difficult a task it is to separate these two isotopes of an atom, which are, for all intents and purposes, they are the same, but isotope 235 is much more reactive, and so they need it exclusively for the bomb. So the image I came up with was trying to take a ball of black clay and a ball of white clay and mixing them together until it's this kind of gray clay, and the task of enrichment is tantamount to separating the colors again from each other once they're all mixed.
This story, this history, is so shaded in controversy and also secrecy, as you said. You can't help but feel like there are many details that are left out of our official history. Were there any parts of the book that you felt were brushed over, that you couldn't find historical references on?
Actually, a lot of the technology and a lot of the work at Los Alamos is now in the public domain. It's declassified. There is still quite a lot to investigate in what the government knew about the effects of radiation before and immediately after the dropping of the bomb. There's a lot of that material is still classified. And I touched on it briefly, the discovery of what doctors called Disease X, the radiation that affected survivors of the attacks in Japan. Mm-hmm. The official story early on was that the government was unprepared for the radioactive fallout that was affecting the survivors.
It's not an extremely graphic history, you know, in the way that a lot of sort of graphic novels or comics are. Still haunting. I really want to thank you for sharing it with us and sharing your time today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Jonathan Fettervorm, the writer and artist behind Trinity, A Graphic History of the First Atomic Bomb. It's a hardcover graphic novel, and you can find more on the book and on his other work. He's done some great work on historical books like The Nature of Things by Lucretius Moby Dick at wordofmouthradio.org. For the startling story of farmers market frauds. And audiobook lovers, listen up. The editor of a magazine dedicated to nothing but reviewing audiobooks tells us what she thinks makes the best books on tape. Think it's easy? We put our crack production team to work recording a little audio literature of our own.
I'm so embarrassed. Damn my clumsiness. I have to steel myself to glance up. Holy cow, he's so young.
Ms. Kavanaugh.
He extends a long-fingered hand to me once I'm upright.
I'm Christian Grey. Are you all right?
Actually...
So young and attractive. Very attractive.
Fifty Shades of Word of Mouth and much more in just a minute.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's no doubt that summer is here. School's out, temperatures are soaring, and farmers markets are popping up in fields and parking lots across the country. Loading up your public radio tote bags with freshly harvested vegetables makes for better tasting food and supports small farmers and the local economy. Except when it doesn't. Jody Helmer wrote about farmers market fakers for Environmental Magazine, and she's on the line to tell us about some of the incidences of faux locals taking advantage of the farmers market phenom. Jody, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
Farmers markets duping consumers. Is nothing sacred?
Apparently not. And it was as much a surprise to me as it was to anyone else.
Are these isolated events or evidence of a trend, do you think?
I think it's evidence of a trend. I think as farmers markets become more plentiful and more popular around the country, there are more people looking, unfortunately, to take advantage of their popularity.
Well, you found some transgressions. Let's go through a few of them, including this one in Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, a woman named Emily Harris discovered something shifty. What happened?
So Emily Harris went to the local farmers market, and she got there very early in the morning, and she noticed that there were some Dole boxes tucked under one of the tables.
Dole like pineapple, bananas,
Dole like pineapple, banana, yes. And she thought, well, maybe it was just something they had used, you know, to transport the produce. And then she saw a farmer at the same table dumping blueberries out of the plastic containers that you get in supermarkets into those blue felted containers that most farmers use, and she realized that something was up.
Buying fruit or veggies at the store, simply merchandising them to look local. Is it that easy to fool consumers?
It can be that easy to fool consumers, and unfortunately, a lot of markets don't have really strong rules about who can sell, so really anyone could set up a booth. So you or I could go to a major supermarket chain, we could buy produce, and then we could resell it at the farmer's market.
Yeah. The regulations of farmer's market, of course, differ from state to state. Here in New Hampshire, farmers do have to register with the State Department of Agriculture. The rules are then set by individual market managers. I certainly haven't heard of them going through and inspecting. What are some of the rules you encountered while researching?
So what I found is that there are two types of markets. there's a market that only allows local sellers. And so they will have rules written into their bylaws that say our farmers need to come from within 50 miles or 100 miles of the market. And they must be farmers, so growing their own produce, raising their own meat, you know, they're harvesting their own eggs. And then there are markets that allow resellers. And a reseller is simply anyone who has not actually grown or raised what they're selling, mm-hmm. and they are buying it from another source and then selling it at the farmer's market.
But of course, the assumption is that the resellers are selling local food.
I think a lot of people assume that. And sometimes, to be fair, that is the case. So if I wanted to buy blueberries, for example, from a local farmer and resell them at the market, it would still be local produce. But you can also buy pineapple or bananas or something that's clearly not grown locally and resell it at the market. And a lot of markets do allow that practice.
Another faux farmers market that you write about was discovered in the parking lot of a popular supermarket, the Safeway in the Seattle area. What happened here?
So what happened here was Safeway advertised that they were going to host a farmer's market in the Seattle area. And their plan was to set up tents in the store parking lot and have staff outside selling produce from the store. And someone tipped off the Washington State Farmers Market Association, which has a really robust membership and some pretty strict rules. And the Farmers Market Association called the corporate offices and explained that in Washington State, the term farmers market is actually mandated.
Mm-hmm.
And it must include farmers selling direct to the public. And to Safeway's credit, they did not know that that was the case. And they immediately backpedaled. They apologized and they said that they were going to change the name so they weren't calling it a farmer's market. But in all likelihood, what happened is consumers were probably duped into believing that they were buying local produce.
Small towns around us, most likely we recognize farmers and vendors. Of course, people travel and shop at other markets. Are there questions that we consumers should be asking to ensure that we're getting real, you know, authentic local produce?
Absolutely. You should absolutely be asking, where was this grown? Did you grow it? Ask questions of the farmer. And, you know, most farmers are really proud of their produce, and they want to talk about where it was grown and how it was grown and how to prepare it and things like that. And so if you're asking those questions and someone can't answer them or is really shady about it, you're probably being duped.
Does that idea of having to test credentials take some of the fun out of the farmer's market, Jody?
I don't think it does, because I think you should look at it as an opportunity to really connect in a very real way with the people who are growing your food. So it's an opportunity to really open a dialogue and create a relationship with your farmer.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Jody Hellman is author of The Green Year, 365 Small Things You Can Do to Make a Big Difference. For a link to her article on Farmers Market Fakery for E, that's the environmental magazine, or to weigh in with your own experience of buying local or not, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Fresh vegetables aren't the only thing local farmers put on display, at least not in Thornton, New Hampshire, where each year Russ Gilman hosts an antique tractor show at his family farm. While old farm machines might not be a big draw for the masses, Word of Mouth correspondent Sean Hurley goes to the show each year. Because an old tractor, at least in his mind, can be a sort of time machine.
The first thing I ever drove by myself was a tractor. I was 5 years old and visiting relatives in Ireland. My Uncle Paddy owned a hilly farm near the sea in Glandore. He set me up into the tractor, put it into gear, and the story is that I crashed the tractor into the barn. He laughed as I cried. It was crooked before, he told me, and I'd just straightened it out. Where I live now in Thornton, there are still a few farms, with cows and horses and tractors brushing about in the old-fashioned fields. Every summer, at the farm up the street, a small, artfully painted sign appears in the meadow. Antique Tractor Show, it says. Country Boys Toys. And for one day only, Russ Gilman's field fills up with old iron machines.
We have a collection of antique tractors. And rather than just setting a building, we said, let's let somebody else enjoy them a little bit. And so we just started doing it, and we get about 200 people a year come by. Some of them come every year. If they're interested in old tractors, they'd love to come because they see so many different ones.
Russ takes me through the barn they built to house their collection. It's like a dirt floor museum, filled with antique Alice Chalmers tractors and crawlers and graders. The oldest tractor is from 1931.
This one here is the oldest one we've got, and that's a hand crank, by the way. You can't put a starter on that engine. There's no way to do it.
And so you've gotten this one running?
Oh, yes. Oh, it runs like a top. Yeah. This tractor over here with a little canopy over it, there's something about that tractor that the kids love. It is probably the most photographed tractor that we by far that we own.
Six-year-old Max Levin is a huge fan of the canopy style.
And I really like the ones like that one with the roof. So, like, I don't know, if you say if it was going to rain, but you had the mow the ground, so you could use one of these big tractors because it has a roof so you don't get wet.
Exactly. And you could also just sit up there sometimes.
Yeah. That's in case you want shade or something, so that's in case you want any. Pretty fun sometimes.
A kid sitting in a tractor in case of shade, or just in case you want any, is, in a way, the point of arrival for almost everyone here. Like Dale Bishop, they all started young.
It probably began for me when I was about this high, and my father had one on the farm, and I drove it. And I worked on a farm until I got out of high school. Mowed, hay, you know, rake, plowed, bales.
And what does your shirt say there?
Oh, it says I'll trade my wife for a tractor. And believe it or not, my wife bought this for me. I think she's hoping somebody will come along with a tractor so she can get rid of me.
Wes Clay used to ride on the tractor fender as his father took them over the fields.
Well, my father, when I was, about so high, used to sell Alice Chalmers tractors back in my late 40s, early 50s. So that's how come I kind of stuck with Alice Chalmers, and most of my big tractors are all Alice Chalmers.
What at first seems a tale of boys and their tractors soon becomes a story of fathers and sons. Russ Gilman has his own memory.
My father worked for the paper company in Lincoln, and I was just a kid during World War II. Every day he would go to a different logging camp somewhere, and of course I loved to go with him. And in the wintertime, we'd get to the camp somewhere. He'd say, well, why don't you take the tractor and plow the road while I've gone up the camp? And one of these was the first one that crawler that I ever ran. So it kind of was in the blood.
Russ stands beside the first crawler he ever ran. They're both about the same age, both still running like tops. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
To see photos Sean took of Russ Gilman and his antique tractors, go to wordofmouthradio.org, where you can also post your thoughts on which grown-up toys transport you back to childhood. Why not post a photo of your favorite time machine at our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, or send us a tweet at Word of Mouth.
I'm not afraid of the black man running. He's got it right. He's got a better life coming.
Coming up, a rundown of some of the best audiobooks to accompany your summer road trips. We'll get the narrative on that when Word of Mouth continues.
I lost my sight and the state packs in. I follow my heart and it leads me right to Jackson.
Yeah.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Summer is book season, with plenty of media outlets and booksellers presenting lists of the best beach reads. Audiobooks rarely get their day in the sun. The literary staple for commuters, road trippers, and too-busy-to-read readers are a fast-growing industry, with a huge cast of actors, reviewers, producers, and an annual awards gala known as the Audies. Here with a rundown of some of the industry's top picks and her thoughts on what makes a top-notch audiobook is Robin Witten. She's founder and editor of Audiophile magazine, which was launched in 1992 as a resource for librarians and has since reviewed thousands of titles. Robin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, Virginia.
How is reviewing audiobooks different from reviewing a traditional or an ebook?
One of the big things is that this is a performance we're listening to when we listen to an audiobook. So there's an actor who's been cast to read a book, and there are all the things about performances that can go right or cannot go right that really affect our enjoyment of an audiobook.
So could a bad performance turn a great book into a not-so-great audiobook?
Well, yes. There could be a miss, indeed. We hate to see that, and usually the producers and publishers spend a lot of time trying to get it right. It may not appeal to everyone, but most of the time we have some pretty sensational performances of the books that are recorded.
Do some genres lend themselves better to being adapted for audio than others?
Well, you know, this is really all about great stories. And so genres like mystery or science fiction, certainly children's books and fiction, are natural for audiobooks.
And of course, the stories with performance. And the publishing industry just held its Oscars, let's call them, for audiobooks, the Audies, on June 5th. Here's just a clip of the winner in these awards in the literary fiction category. Here is the actress Hope Davis. She's reading from Ann Patchett's State of Wonder.
Wouldn't she call you? There has to be some sort of global satellite. She won't use the phone, or she says it doesn't work there. As close as they were in this quiet room, she could scarcely hear his voice. But for this, she stopped herself. Where is he now? Morena asked. She could not bring herself to say his body. Anders was not a body.
What makes this performance rise above others, Robin?
Well, I think there's a lot of emotional engagement. Something about what Hope Davis is doing is bringing you into that story. So you're emotionally engaged in what's going on. You have to listen.
It's also amazing that they have to do so many different voices. I mean, I've listened to some with various different accents and male voices, female. It must be pretty challenging.
It's very challenging. And when you have, you know, three or four people in conversation, all male, you know, some with different accents, maybe they're all Western sheriff. And they're having a conversation. This is huge challenges for the narrator.
Another book that got a rave review at Audiophile is Canada by Richard Ford, a novelist I absolutely love, narrated here by Holder Graham. Let's listen.
My mother had shoved over into the driver's seat after my father had parked behind the bank. She'd pushed the seat far forward so her feet would reach. She was waiting with the engine started when he came out the alley with his canvas bag. He got straight into the back seat, crouched under a blanket, and she pulled slowly away so nothing that had gone on in the bank would seem to have anything to do with a white and red Chevrolet Bel Air with North Dakota plates idling out of town toward the west.
Now, Robin, this is a brand new audiobook, so it was not a contender for this year's Audies, but you gave it a great review. What do you like about it?
Well, you know, I think what I love about this is Holter Graham really gets the pace of this novel down. You can hear the pace is quite different from the previous clip. You want to know what's going on. What's happening here? This is a young boy, so you get a little sense of that from the narration. You know, this is what Richard Ford has put into the text and the narrator is bringing to us as a performance.
One of the big winners was Tina Fey. In fact, she won, I'm seeing here, two categories for the book of the year and also for memoir. This is, she read her own memoir, Bossy Pants. Let's listen to her.
Welcome, friend. Congratulations on your purchase of this American-made genuine audiobook. Each component of this audiobook was selected to provide you with maximum audio performance, whatever your listening needs may be. If you're a woman and you bought this audiobook for practical tips on how to make it in a male-dominated workplace, here they are. No pigtails, no tube tops, cry sparingly. Some people say, never let them see you cry.
I say if you're so mad you could just cry, then cry. It terrifies everyone.
Tina Fey. Sounding very much like Tina Fey there.
It does.
So it sort of won the best picture, I guess, for audiobooks this year, but she kind of customized it for audio. Is that typical?
Well, I think it's one of the great things in something like this that's a memoir, it's a personal story, and the producers, you know, said go for it. Boy, did she do a great job.
Let's touch on a couple of other audiobook genres. Children's books. The Audi winner in that category was Weird Al Yankovic. Let's hear from that.
When I grow up, what am I going to be? That's something I'd really been thinking about, and I just couldn't wait to let all those thoughts out.
Sounds like a natural for Weird Al Yankovic. But Robin, I do have to ask, are there ever pretty bad books that end up becoming award-worthy audiobooks?
Well, we would hope not. There are some audiobooks that maybe will appeal to some people and not others. You know, I think I'd rather listen to a traditional tale than Weird Al for too long. It's sort of like some of those annoying children's recordings. But, you know, the kids probably play it again and again.
And parents listen along with them. Diplomatic answer, and I want to thank you, Robin, for your time.
Thank you.
Robin Witten, founder and editor of Audiophile magazine. Now, there's a link to the magazine's website, which includes reviews and sound from thousands of audiobooks, as well as a list of the winners of the Audis. And there are a zillion categories. Whether you listen to audiobooks or not, there's a whole world to discover. Now, while we were prepping for our talk with Robin, we wondered whether we, radio makers, could pass as audiobook producers, maybe even elevating a book of dubious quality by getting just the right people to read it. So we took a dramatic stab at an excerpt from the hottest book around, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Here is NHPR's Sam Evans Brown and Josh Rogers from the newsroom and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie reading a scene. This is of the series heroine. She's Anastasia Steele, meeting her future paramour for the first time.
Mr. Grey will see you now, Miss Steele. Do go through,
blonde number two says. I stand rather shakily, trying to suppress my nerves. Gathering up my backpack, I abandon my glass of water and make my way to the partially open door.
You don't need to knock. Just go in.
I push open the door and stumble through, tripping over my own feet and falling head first into the office. Double crap. Me and my two left feet. I'm on my hands and knees in the doorway to Mr. Gray's office, and gentle hands are around me, helping me to stand. I'm so embarrassed. Damn my clumsiness. I have to steel myself to glance up. Holy cow, he's so young.
Miss Cavanaugh.
He extends a long-fingered hand to me once I'm upright.
I'm Christian Grey. Are you all right?
Actually...
So young and attractive. Very attractive. He's tall, dressed in a fine gray suit, white shirt, and a black tie with unruly dark copper-colored hair and intense, bright gray eyes that regard me shrewdly. It takes a moment for me to find my voice.
Miss Cavanaugh is indisposed, so she sent me. I hope you don't mind, Mr. Grey.
And you are?
His voice is warm, possibly amused, but it's difficult to tell from his impassive expression. He looks mildly interested, but above all, polite.
Anastasia Steele. I'm studying English literature with Kate, Catherine, Miss Cavanaugh at WSU Vancouver.
I see.
He says simply. I think I see a ghost of a smile in his expression, but I'm not sure.
Would you like to sit?
He waves me toward an L-shaped white leather couch. His office is way too big for just one man. In front of the floor-to-ceiling windows, there's a modern dark wood desk that six people could comfortably eat around. Everything else is white, except for the wall by the door, where a mosaic of small paintings hang. They're exquisite.
A local artist, Trutone,
says Gray as he catches my gaze.
They're lovely, raising the ordinary to extraordinary.
I couldn't agree more, Miss Steele,
he replies, his voice soft, and for some inexplicable reason, I find myself blushing.
Somewhat unsaucy excerpt from the mega-selling 50 Shades of Grey, acted out by NHPR's Rebecca Lavoie and Sam Evans Brown, with Josh Rogers making a cameo as Christian Grey. So what's the expression? Can't make a silk purse out of a cow's ear? Well, they gave it their all.
Written.
We're always grateful to have you spend some time with us. If you did miss any of today's program, you can listen, and you can also share segments online at wordofmouthradio.org or tune in anytime by downloading our podcast on iTunes. You can also access us anytime on the free NHPR iPhone app. I'm Virginia Prescott, inviting you to join me again next week for more new ideas, bubbling up trends, and stories from under the radar. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Todd Bookman,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
Andrew Perella provides technical support.
And Dan Kogan runs our board.
Now for the legalese.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals, like myself.
Not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
I'm out. Done. Hit it. Thanks, Rebecca.